I want to begin this morning by telling you about a classic. A classic, you know, in Mark Twain's definition, is a book that everyone wants to have read, but no one wants to read. All those books in school that you wish you had already read, but actually you have to read them, although this happens to be a very readable classic, although it's one that most people probably have not heard of these days. It was published in 1931, and it's actually a classic work on intellectual history called The Heavenly City of the 18th Century Philosophers, and it's by an American historian named Carl Becker. And even though it really is a very readable and wonderful book, I'm about to spare you the trouble, because I'll give you the essence of what it's about, since what it's about is actually extremely important in many of the debates, deliberations that we have in politics and in religion today. What Becker wrote about were the philosophers of the Enlightenment, Voltaire and many, many of Voltaire's associates, who wanted to throw out religion as the arbiter of what was good and what was bad in society. And they wanted to be able to talk about things morally without making any reference to religion, to say what was good and what was bad based on what they called natural law, law that you derive from the way the world works and not from some ancient book. Now, as you can imagine, by the way, this position is a very popular position these days as well. People want to derive what's right and what's wrong, not from religion, but from some kind of natural law, either because they feel it deep in their hearts, or they know what's good, or they want it to be consistent with human dignity, something else. But Becker pointed out, and this is what made his book so powerful and so innovative and still so important, Becker pointed out that despite the fact that the philosophers wanted to get rid of religion, they couldn't avoid sneaking religious language in the back door. Because one of the things that they discovered is if you want to use nature as the basis of natural law, you have a problem, which is nature is sometimes not very nice. Natural law can't only be people being nice to each other. What about the fact that in the world, not only in the animal world, where animals are not very nice to one another, all you have to do is turn on television to know that, but even in the cosmos, where stars collide and galaxies go in and out of existence, there doesn't seem to be a lot of basis for getting people to be nice. And the more we know about nature, the less it seems that you can draw natural laws from nature. Animals, at times, are what we would consider very cruel. But we don't call them cruel because, after all, they're animals. And if you can't generalize from animals and you can't generalize from stars, then what's left of natural law other than what people feel you should do? But as you know and I know, feeling what you should do is a very unreliable guide to what you should in fact do. Sometimes what you feel you should do to the driver who just cut you off is not what you should do. Just ask the judge. Because if you do, you might find yourself in front of some of her colleagues, and they'll tell you, you shouldn't have done what you felt you wanted to do. And so what happened, said Becker, is that all these Enlightenment philosophers started to sneak in religious values without calling them religious. Like, for example, human dignity. Human dignity is a wonderful thing. We're all for human dignity. The problem is, what makes human dignity a value if there's no religious structure and no God to give human beings dignity by being in God's image? What if, in fact, We are solely the products of natural processes, just like giraffes and amoebas and mountains. Why are we so dignified? Just because we think we are? And what if I think I'm dignified, but you're not so dignified? And so, what you get is a lot of public discussion about things based on morals that are very hard to defend. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, why so many public debates don't go anywhere, because people don't share common moral ground, because they have very different ideas about what human dignity is. One person says that being pro-choice is consistent with human dignity, because a woman has to have control over her own body. That's what it means to have human dignity. Someone else says being pro-life is consistent with human dignity, because that means that the life that is developing in the woman's womb has to have dignity. And you realize that human dignity is one other way of reinforcing what you believe, but it doesn't give you any kind of consistent principle, and so it's a mess. And all sorts of modern political philosophers, by the way, have tried to find their way out of it. One famous example that's recounted in a book that I'm reading is by Martha Nussbaum. She says we should talk about human capabilities instead of talking about human dignity. That every society has to provide areas for human capabilities to flourish. That's what makes it a good society. And again, the problem is that we've got capabilities, and we've got capabilities. We have capabilities for freedom, for kindness, for goodness, for expression, for art, for beauty, and we have capabilities for hatred and cruelty and war and violence. And who decides which capability is the capability that you should express? I bring all this up because this is a consistent debate among those who favor the idea of religion as a foundation for human morality and those who think that religion is bad for human morality. And it's true, and everyone knows it. You can be completely non-religious and be a wonderful person, and you can be very religious and not be so wonderful. This is not, by the way, a new idea. Nachmanides, Ramban, said over 1,000 years ago, or close to 1,000 years ago, that you can be naval birshut haTorah, that you can be, naval is a jerk, basically, that you can be a jerk with the permission of the Torah. In other words, you can follow all the rules, you can have two sets of dishes and two dishwashers and never go out on Shabbos except when you walk to synagogue and still be a no good SOB. That's a direct quote from my Nachmanides. Okay, I adjusted the language a little, but you get the idea. We all know that this is true, but right now we're not talking about whether a religious person can be a lousy human being or whether a non-religious person can be a good person. The question is, what's underneath it? And by the way, every debate that I have with everyone who represents the atheistic position, Hitchens, Harris, Pinker, all of them, always we have this same debate. Is religion good for morals or is it not good? And always you hear people using religious language even if they're not religious. What is good? What is sacred? What is kind? All those things that we have in religious sources but don't get used in religious ways. And I bring it up because we should know something that we don't always pay attention to, which is that all of Judaism, ultimately, if you ask what's the end purpose of it, why do we do all this? It is to produce goodness. It's not to produce Jews. It's to produce goodness. That doesn't mean that there aren't all these other goals along the way. Do you want to produce Jews? Yes. Do you want to do what God says? Yes. Do you want to create community and solidarity and happiness? And yes, all of that, but that's not the ultimate goal. The mitzvot are given to us, the Talmud says more than once, rak litzaref et habriot. Rak means only. The mitzvot are given only to refine human character. In other words, that you should be good. That's the end product. It doesn't mean that there aren't lots of other goals along the way. But if you ask, what ultimately does Judaism want of the world? It's goodness. Which is why you have this amazing, astonishing passage in the Talmud. And maybe even if you've heard the story, and I suspect that most of us have, you may not realize how amazing the story is about the guy who wants to convert, and he comes to Shammai and he says, give me all of Judaism on one foot. And Shammai thinks he's mocking him, so he chases him out of the house, presumably on 2 feet. And the guy, by the way, speaking of 1 foot, that may not be what the Talmud really means. My teacher of blessed memory, Eliezer Slomovic, once pointed out to me that the Hebrew is al regel echad, right? Regel is a foot, like regalim, right? Regalim are the festivals. They're called the festivals because people used to go on foot up to Jerusalem. But he said, in Latin, regula means a principle, like a regulation. So in fact, the guy may have been saying, give it to me in one principle, which would mean the same thing, right? But we got it as 1 foot. Anyway, whether it's 1 foot or one principle, Shammai didn't want to do it. Then he comes to Hillel. And what does Hillel say to him? He says, what is hateful to you, don't do to anyone else. He says, that is the law and the Torah and the prophets, and now all the rest is commentary. Go and learn. Okay, Zil Gomor, a very famous story. But here's what struck me the 1,000th time I heard that story. What Hillel says to him is the whole of the Torah, that which is hateful to you, you shouldn't do to anyone else, is nowhere in the Torah. When I suddenly realized that, I was shocked. You come to a famous rabbi, you ask him what the Torah is about, and he gives you a sentence that doesn't appear in the Torah. He could have said, love your neighbor as yourself. That's in the Torah. He could have said, I'm the Lord your God. That's in the Torah. Instead, he picks this line that's not in the Torah. But what it tells you is all of the Torah, all of it, is about this. And he doesn't want to pick one part of the Torah as if to suggest that this expresses what is about the Torah is about, but that other part doesn't. What we read this morning in Tazria Mitzorah, that's not what the Torah is about. It's about this other part. So he picks a sentence that's not in the Torah at all to summarize everything that the Torah tells you. Everything. And it's all about goodness. And the reason that it's all about goodness, of course, is the undergirding of the Torah is that God creates everything, and therefore every human being is in God's image. And you know, a way of thinking of it is this. Let's say you grow up with someone and you love them, your best friend. You spend your whole childhood together. And then in adulthood, you know, they live in one city, you live in another, and one day, their child shows up at your door. You're going to love that child because it's the child of someone you love. That's the principle. Everyone is a child of God. Everyone is a child of someone that we should love. And because of that, goodness is the first command. When that child shows up at the door, you say, I'm going to take care of this person because I love their parents. That principle of goodness is what Hillel was expressing. All the rest of it is commentary because there's a lot to unpack about how to be good in this world. There are lots of choices to be made, difficult choices, painful choices, but ultimately we have to keep our eye on the theological ball, which is we're supposed to be good. That's why we're here. That's our mission. And all the other words that you hear, like tikkun olam, fixing the world, that's all about ultimately being good. And people who have lived and seen life and understood life understand this. Henry James, the great American novelist, at the end of his life, said the 3 most important things in life are to be kind, and to be kind. Same thing Hillel was saying. That because there is a God in this world, there's a commandment to be good. And the commandment to be good precedes all other commandments. And all other commandments are an attempt to educate our souls, to elevate our souls to goodness. That's why it is so important that we understand that nothing else, no other observance, no other practice, no other part, membership in community, none of it takes us away from the obligation to be good to other human beings. That's the fundamental. That's the one again and again and again. If you look at the Al-Khaits on Yom Kippur, they're all about what we do to other people. Some of them are about what we do to God, but the vast majority are about how we have mistreated others, because it's about being kind. So, when you hear these public debates, I hope that it frames it for all of us as Jews and as human beings in this way, the idea that every human being is in the image of God. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat or an independent, if you're right or if you're left. If you speak in a way that diminishes the humanity of the other side, it's un-Jewish. It is un-Jewish. Goodness, kindness, that's the first commandment and the last one. Let me just close by reminding you of what the Torah reminds us of. It says, the Torah begins and ends with God performing deeds of loving kindness. It begins with God creating clothes for Adam and Eve, and it ends with God burying Moses. Because God is modeling for us that from the moment someone comes into this world until the moment they leave this world, our obligation is to act with chesed, with goodness, with kindness. It's what God does. It's what we ought to do. And our tradition tells us why. Because we are B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God. It's true of every human being. It's just that sometimes we don't act like it. Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom.